Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to this evening's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, chair of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum, and chair of this program. And now I'll introduce today's distinguished speaker. Paul R. Lindy, M.D., is a San Francisco-based author and clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCSF School of Medicine, and has worked in several high-intensity psychiatric settings over the past few years. In the last 5 years, he has worked in a variety of settings. His main job is as an emergency psychiatrist at San Francisco General Hospital, where he performs tasks of medical triage, crisis stabilization, rapid behavioral assessment and treatment, and psychiatric consultation in the General Hospital Emergency Department. He also teaches UCSF interns, residents, and students on an apprenticeship model. As medical director of the Stonewall Project, he evaluates and treats methamphetamine-dependent gay and bisexual men, many with HIV/AIDS, in an outpatient harm reduction treatment program. He also works with and supervises a clinical pharmacist, psychologist, and substance abuse counselors. His clinical work has focused primarily on people suffering from chronic mental illness, substance abuse, and dual diagnoses. He strives to combine the best of the scientific advancements in clinical psychopharmacology with innovative psychosocial interventions and a special emphasis on quality of life for this population, which is often discovered in cultural and spiritual realms. His first book, Of Spirits and Madness, An American Psychiatrist in Africa, was published by McGraw-Hill in 2002. Dr. Lindy has also written for JAMA, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Mercury News, and Double Take Magazine. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with his wife, who's a pediatrician, two sons, and a rambunctious one-eyed dog. He has a very extensive educational background, including St. John's University, University of Minnesota, in University of California, San Francisco. He started Danger to Self in 2005, heading to the Castro District flat that houses the Sanchez Writer's Grotto whenever he was not with his family. His children now in third and fifth grades. At San Francisco General or at the Stonewall Project. Due to privacy concerns, he changed the identities of patients and some of the portraits are composites. He covers a range of hot-button issues in psychiatry, but the book's power comes from vivid description of the sights, sounds, and suffering Lindy witnessed. So, Dr. Lindy.
Thanks, Bill, for that introduction. And the only thing I really want to know is, do I get to pound the gavel or not? I'm just kidding. Sorry. And then I was going to say the last time I saw a gavel was in a courtroom, but that didn't sound appropriate either, so... It's really my distinct pleasure to be here tonight. When I got the invitation to speak at the Commonwealth Club, I have to say I was a little bit blown away. And standing out there in the hallway and looking at the photos in the hallway and seeing some of the luminaries you've had here, all I can say is I'm probably really not worthy, but I'll do the best I can this evening anyway. But Bill, I really want to thank you for that introduction and thank you for inviting me to this event tonight. I also want to briefly thank folks at UC Press, Naomi Schneider and Alex Donne, who've helped me quite a bit in the process. And also thank one of my colleagues, Dr. Cam Quanbeck, who's here tonight, who helped do some of the research of things I'm going to be talking about tonight. So you can put that up there. So it's really a pleasure for me to be here. The only financial conflict of interest I have is the fact that I wrote a book and I'll be selling it after the event tonight. I'm not tied to any other financial institutions. So I want to put tonight's talk into a context. for those of you who are familiar with the forensic areas of psychiatry or the law, there's a difference between what we call a percipient witness and an expert witness. The percipient witness is one who really tells what he or she saw and observes in the course of events. And of course, a percipient witness is not being paid by either the defense or the prosecution. Whereas the expert witness puts a spin on the events and tells the jury and the judge really their version of the events of what happened. And so I consider myself much more of a percipient witness in that I'm not really an expert because I haven't published in this area. But what I have done is I've worked for almost 20 years, two or three times a week at Psychiatric Emergency at San Francisco General. So I've had a chance to observe many, many things over the years there. So I sort of see myself as a percipient witness with really no conflicts of interest. So I really wrote this book because I wanted to tell people what I saw and what I experienced and try to give you a sense of what it's really like there and what the issues are that we're struggling with. So I'm a percipient witness, not an expert. The themes I want to touch on tonight really are more in the policy realm. I probably will do a small bit of reading later in the talk, right before the Q&A. But this is really different than the bookstore events that I've done and even other academic events that I've done, in that I want to take the opportunity to begin a discussion about policy and mental health policy and how the current laws as they're written, the civil commitment laws, affect the way that psychiatrists practice and the way that even funding happens here in San Francisco and throughout the country, and talk a bit about the history of how those laws came to pass and basically what have some of the unintended consequences have been of the law. The main sort of patient I want to think about tonight are really the people that you see scattered around San Francisco, the homeless, seriously mentally ill. And certainly down here downtown, you know, it's hard to not come across the homeless mentally ill. And I'm talking about the really ill people that you see who are wearing multiple layers of clothes, who often have a very strong odor, who probably haven't bathed in several weeks, who sometimes are sitting in their own urine, who sometimes yell out in response to voices in their heads. The people that really are the sickest of the sick. And I want to kind of just focus a little bit on, you know, how it is that this society hasn't really found a way to care for those people, and to talk about sort of the history and the law around those issues, and then perhaps talk about some ways that things could be different. You know, here in San Francisco, I would say that the seriously mentally ill are among the most disenfranchised and marginalized members of society, and I think it's true in throughout the United States. Because of that, it's really easy for politicians to cut these services because these are people who don't vote, who don't advocate for themselves, and I think that's one of the huge themes I want to talk about tonight, and that is sort of what I would call stinginess. I was kind of looking for the right adjective to describe what it is, and it's really, it's stinginess. It's a lack of willingness on, you know, policymakers and our society to pay for the care of the most vulnerable people in our society. I think the other side of the coin, however, is also interesting in that, and I know this might prompt some debate in the Q&A, but I'm going to put myself out there, and that is what I call wishful thinking. Wishful thinking on the part of people who call themselves libertarians, saying that, well, you know, the most seriously mentally ill are able to make decisions for themselves, that they're competent to make decisions for themselves. And that's an assumption. I mean, many people with mental illness are perfectly capable of making decisions. So I'm not talking about the people with a more moderate degree of illness who are doing okay. I'm talking about the sickest of the sick. And to me, those are the two sides of the coin, this sort of stinginess and then also wishful thinking. But before I get into those more theoretical realms, I wanted to talk a little bit about the kind of patients that I see that specifically fall through the cracks because of the way the laws are written. But before I do that, I want to talk about the number one problem that we see, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time tonight, but that is people who, in the lingo where I work, it's the mantra is, if you want to stay, you have to go. And that's from the patient's perspective. So we have patients who want to stay, but we end up discharging them. And the reason we have patients like this is the way the laws are written, in that we're supposed to be in a position to predict dangerousness. We're supposed to be in a position to predict whether someone might commit suicide or not. And that's one of the main criteria we use. So it gets out in the community that if you want help, I mean, I'm not even talking about people who are malingering to avoid going to jail or to, you know, just be taken care of. I'm talking about people who really need help, who don't know where to get it. And so the word on the street is, okay, go to general. And if you go to general, they can be pretty mean there. The triage nurses can be really mean. But what you have to tell them is, you have to tell them, first of all, you got to tell them you're going to kill yourself. Because that's the way to get in the door is threatening suicide. So number one, tell them you're going to kill yourself. And that's probably not going to be enough. You know, you're going to have to think of a really lethal way to do it. And that's probably not going to be enough either. You got to tell them you're hearing voices telling you to do that to yourself. So the problem is a triage nurse gets a litany of these kind of presentations. And, you know, we're really not mind readers. There is no crystal ball. And it's easy to get very cynical and say, oh, another one of these. Yeah, right. Sure. Tell me about it. You know, I mean, the more cynical members of my staff, they might not say that to a patient, but in their mind, okay, here we go again. But the problem is that trying to sort out who really needs to come in the door or not. And so, you know, you can sort that out over time. If you observe somebody over several hours and interview them more than once, you can kind of sort those things out. But that really is a direct result of the way the law was written. So that's one problem. I'm not going to belabor that anymore. I have a whole, you know, chapter about people who, I mean, there are people who play the suicide card to avoid getting arrested. I mean, it's a totally rational act, right? I mean, I don't blame these folks. I mean, you know, it's a good call on their part. So that's one problem, playing the suicide card. The second problem I want to spend more time on, because I sort of feel like this group of patients, the most vulnerable are the ones that we really should be thinking about taking better care of. And this goes under the classic rule number two. Rule number one of psychemergency, if you want to stay, you have to go. Rule number two is its converse. If you want to go, you have to stay. So these are patients who, the classic one is someone who's acutely manic. There's nothing wrong with me. You know, people are literally super manic, and they may have already crashed their car, and they may have already beaten up their partner, and they may have already maxed out their credit cards, and they may have slept 5 hours in the last 2 weeks, but I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. So those are the people, obviously, that want to go. The other example is someone who, you know, the person I described to you who's out on the streets in multiple layers of clothes, who wants to go, does not want to stay in the hospital. Now, there's a problem in the system because the way the law is written and the way the economics of healthcare are, those are the patients we don't really admit anymore. I mean, I'm just going to come out and say it. And the reason we still do, but we don't admit them as readily as 20 years ago. And the reason is the state doesn't want to pay for their care because they're not dangerous. Right? They're not dangerous. This guy's harmless. He's choosing to live on the street like that. You know, that's a sad story. I mean, these are the words that have rolled out of administrators' mouths. That is a sad story. What's psychiatric about it? Well, what's psychiatric about it is a guy with chronic schizophrenia who doesn't have any treatment, who's not taking care of himself. But basically, the point I'm trying to make is the way the law is written is, if they're not dangerous, the state of California... And when I say the state of California, I really mean Medi-Cal doesn't want to pay for it. And essentially, the reviewers we have in the hospital are really, they're not from the state, but they go by the state criteria. And that is, the state says, well, you know, basically it's a matter of trying to spend less money. And if we say, well, we're going to spend money on people who are dangerous for public safety, let's do that. But in terms of someone who's not dangerous, we don't want to pay the money. So So essentially, the responsibility goes up the chain pretty quickly all the way to the federal government as well. So this is a real-time issue. This is happening now in San Francisco. At San Francisco General Hospital, as of March, so coming up in a month or so, we're going to go from 42 acute inpatient psychiatric beds to 21 acute inpatient psychiatric beds. The rationale is essentially that the mid-year budget cuts have come through, the mid-year budget reductions have come through, and they've basically been passed through the mayor's office, Department of Public Health, and they're passed through to every department, Department of Public Health. I mean, it's a brutal budget cycle, obviously. It's a terrible economy. So what this means is that there's going to be more pressure on people like me working in psych emergency trying to decide who gets admitted and who doesn't get admitted. And it's, you know, this is real time. The last shift I worked was on Friday, and, you know, I had people that I felt like needed to be in the hospital just because they're so ill. And I had to really advocate for them and make a case for them being in the hospital. And, you know, the administrators, it's not like they come and say, you can't admit this guy, you know, because their hands are a bit tied as well, because the state will come in and decertify their care on day two or three. So the hospital get paid for 2 days, but then the hospital's under pressure to discharge this guy day three or four before they've really had a chance to really stabilize. So, of course, as you can imagine, this leads to a revolving door phenomenon and recidivism, and some of the same patients keep coming through, you know, really without their needs being adequately met. Now, the city, you know, I mean, for me, it's easy to get upset at the Department of Public Health. I wish they would make mental health a greater priority. They do spend a lot of money. There are a lot of really good people out there in the outpatient world, a lot of really good psychiatrists, psych techs, nurses, social workers, psychologists, every mental health stripe you can think of. They're out there doing good work, and they work hard. But, you know, they're also living death by 1,000 cuts. And so it really raises the question, as 2/3 of California counties have gotten out of inpatient psychiatry, is San Francisco looking to do the same? And I just think it's an open question. Now, I'll say this. I mean, the hospital is going to 21 acute beds. They still will have 42 what they call non-acute beds, and it's hard to know how that's going to play out. There are patients who are waiting for placement at longer-term locked facilities who've been decertified, which means the state, instead of giving them $600 a day, I'm pulling those figures out of the air, instead of giving them $600 a day for acute care, are giving them $100 for non-acute care. So, I mean, it's a financial shell game. And, you know, ultimately to me, and I, you know, I don't really like to talk about politics. I didn't set out to talk about politics when I wrote this book, and I'm going to change the subject pretty soon anyway. But, you know, basically it goes all the way up the line, and I think it really goes all the way to the federal government. I mean, the federal government doesn't make it a priority either. I mean, if you look at the money that goes to TARP, that goes to war, it seems like the federal government is, you know, they're kind of getting out of the business of healthcare in some respect. So I'm not going to open that whole Pandora's box right now. But the point I'm making is that in patient psychiatry, it's expensive, it's complex. The outcome measures are a little bit ambiguous. I mean, it's not as clear-cut as outcomes in med-surg. But the literature shows that for someone who's been off their medication, for someone who's been drinking a lot of alcohol or abusing drugs, that they really need in the range probably of 2 to 4 weeks to restabilize before being able to go back out there. Well, hey, folks, the length of stay is less than a week. You know, it's just people don't... And this is true in the private sector as well. I mean, this is not just a public sector phenomenon. Inpatient psychiatry is a money loser, unfortunately. And I also know in the private sector, so for example, Kaiser has no inpatient psych beds. I don't know if people know that or not, but Kaiser being a huge healthcare force in Northern California, they contract out their inpatient psychiatric care. Sutter Health, if you read the handwriting on the wall, they're kind of looking to get out of inpatient psychiatry because it's a money loser. It remains to be seen how they do in terms of when they rebuild St. Luke's, will they include inpatient psych beds or not? So I'm not trying to be too pessimistic here, but just so the members of the public know that this is kind of what's on the line when you see people out in public one of the big reasons is economic, of why they're still out there. There's just not the financial capital or interest in taking care of these kinds of patients. So I don't know what we're going to do at the hospital. I think just do what we always do, just do the best you can. I mean, you come down, at the end of the day, I do an assessment, I come up with an ideal world plan, right? Okay, in an ideal world, what would this person need? What would be best for this person? And I can say, you know, maybe 1 out of 10 times I can come up with the ideal world plan. So then I got to go to choice 2, which is not bad. And, you know, I can get choice 2 sometimes, but, you know, probably half the time I'm left holding the bag, and the patient's really left holding the bag. I'm like, hey, you know, I used to know a guy at that clinic who saw patients, but, you know, that clinic's closed. The city closed that clinic. Or, you know, it happens every day in real time, real people sitting in front of me where I can't get them the kind of referral they need when they leave. So the problem is that throughout the United States, these days, the sickest of the sick are in places like jail, like prison, homeless shelters. And then just a stone's throw from here are I hate to use the word, it sounds sort of histrionic, but ghettos. I mean, the Tenderloin with all the single room occupancy hotels, you know, the many, many of the folks living there in sort of substandard housing are the chronically mentally ill. And also people with chronic addiction and alcohol problems, which is a whole nother slice of the pie here. The other ghetto is the other way. I don't know if I'm pointing in the right direction. 850 Bryant, the county jail. I think it's safe to say that probably 10% of the patients, so the inmates at San Francisco County Jail have serious mental illness as well. So that is specifically an outcome of deinstitutionalization in the early 1960s. So I'm going to have a little drink of water, and we're going to turn the clock back to deinstitutionalization. So how do we get here? I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time reviewing this topic because it's written about and talked about elsewhere, but I'm going to try to summarize where we've gone in the last 200 years of mental health care in the United States. And frankly, before I start the story, I can say rather than being 21st century care, we're kind of 19th century care right now in terms of where people are physically, in terms of medication, in terms of our understanding. We're 21st century, and so there's reason for hope. I mean, we have the tools to come back to 21st century. The problem is we don't really have the financial will to do so. But basically what happened is in the 19th century, Dorothea Dix is a very important figure in the history of the United States. She saw mentally ill people in all sorts of mostly jail-type situations and being neglected. And she came up with the concept in the middle of the century of asylum. And the word asylum used to not be such a loaded, dirty word as it sometimes is now. Asylum really did mean refuge, that she saw that the people there didn't deserve to be punished. They deserved to be taken care of and treated. So she gave up the concept of asylum. Now, this morphed into state mental institutions throughout the United States, the latter half of the 19th century, the early part of the 20th century. Unfortunately, these institutions had serious problems of their own. And in fact, unfortunately, a lot of overcrowding and problems, abuse and other difficulties in those conditions. So by the middle of the 20th century, there really was a rise in trying to get people out of these institutions. And a few really important things happened. One is basically psychiatrists, I would say, became arrogant and they overreached with some of the treatments they were offering at the times. And I've talked to psychiatrists from that era, I mean, some of whom in their 70s now, who were young in that era, and talked to them about what they did. And basically they said, listen, you know, there were desperate times to call for desperate measures. But I mean, in retrospect, things like fever treatment, insulin coma, frontal lobotomies, electroconvulsive therapy without anesthesia, which these days is done as a outpatient office procedure, a surgical procedure, essentially, that between that, the treatments, and between the fact there was no due process, that people would stay in the hospital for months and months and months at a time without any due process to get out, And that family members could have other family members committed. I mean, this obviously led to a huge problem. You had people stuck in pretty nasty conditions month after month after month with really no way of getting out. And obviously, and then sometimes being subject to these very, very aggressive, invasive treatments. And so you had a situation that was untenable. So that whole thing was brewing. But there's also a political element. And the history of LPS is really interesting. So LPS refers to Lantrum and Petrus Short. That's the name of the three California legislators who drafted civil commitment law. It was passed in 1967, implemented in 1969. And LPS law, basically what we refer to mostly as 5150 law. And if you've heard the term 5150, that stands for the California Welfare and Institutions Code, Legal Code 5150. And basically that's the legal code that has jurisdiction over whether someone can be held against their will in a psychiatric setting for an evaluation for up to 72 hours. And the three criteria are danger to self, which basically means being suicidal, danger to others, which means being potentially violent or homicidal, and gravely disabled. And gravely disabled means being unable to care for your basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter on the basis of a severe psychiatric illness. So these were the three criteria. 43 years later, these are still the same three criteria. And there were other things that happened around late 60s, early 1970s. Another thing that happened then was Frank Lanterman, who drafted the law, was a conservative legislator from Pasadena. And he had ties to John Birch Society, Daughters of the American Revolution, very, very conservative organizations. And he said, and those around him said, that psychiatric hospitals were Marxist tools, that basically that the people in hospitals were political prisoners. And so there was this, under a cry of libertarianism, and what I would call political cover of libertarianism, say, let these poor people go. So, but really what the fiscal side was driving it as well, that essentially that there was a lot of money to be saved by closing these state hospitals. 1960, there's 500,000 people in state hospitals in the United States. 1980, there's 100,000. So basically, this was under the cover of libertarianism, there was a fiscal drive to actually empty out the state hospitals as well. Now, his colleague in this, so you have a really an arch conservative slash libertarian from Southern California. His co-author, Nicholas Petrus, is from Oakland, described in the literature as ultra-liberal, and he was more of the school of thought that grew up under the myth of mental illness by Thomas Saz, R.D. Lang, the divided self, that there was a whole groundswell on the left of saying that mental illness was a myth, and that, you know, these are just kind of misunderstood, eccentric, poor characters, and we should just, you know, let them go. And so you had far right, far left, and then Short was just sort of thrown in at the end. I can't tell you much about him except his first name was Alan. So Lanterman, Petrus, Short. So you had this sort of unholy political alliance, and so this law was crafted. Now, simultaneously, there was a very important judicial decision in Wisconsin, Lessard versus the state of Wisconsin. In Lessard, it was a three-judge panel, and the upshot of Lessard was that, number one, we're only going to look at dangerousness for putting people in the hospital against their will. We're not going to look at grave disability at all. Number two, there was an assumption that people would have full capacity to make decisions regarding their illness. And I think we can say 40 years later, we now know from a biological and neurological standpoint, for the most severely ill, again, I'm talking about probably, you know, 5% of a larger group, for the most severely ill, they are lacking capacity. And we now sort of, we know that. So sort of the upshot of this is that these LPS laws passed, and the real problem was that there was money promised to be funneled from the closing of the state hospitals to funnel into the community. And actually, it sounds good. It sounds great. Hey, if we can have these people in the community living in a more home-like setting or at home, it's wonderful. It's definitely an improvement. And I think the public bought it. It's a good notion. And I think if the money had actually passed through, that some of these problems would have been, you know, forestalled, basically. But what happened is John F. Kennedy actually passed what's called the Community Mental Health Centers Act, or shepherded that through, and promised at the time $3 billion, which at the time was a huge amount of money. Well, of course, you know the rest of the history of the early 60s. He was assassinated. Vietnam War came up. I mean, lots of other priorities came to the forefront. And that money, I mean, I don't have the exact details, but the money never materialized. So you had an emptying out of hospitals in the 60s without the money following to help care for these people. You had a new set of commitment laws that actually made it very hard to get people back in, even an acute hospital, to get, as we say in the business, tuned up, you know, for a week or two. And so this meant that, you know, where did the homeless mental, well, I guess I gave you the answer, where do these folks go? And I think research has been really clear showing that many of them ended up homeless, many of them ended up incarcerated, and many of them really ended up victimized as well. I mean, it's harder to quantify that, but I think that's the reality as well. And so if you look at numbers, it's very sobering. So any one day in California, 38,000 seriously mentally ill people are in county jail in California on any given day, 38,000. It's thought to be about 10% of the county jail population. 10,000, wait a second, am I getting my facts messed up here? So maybe that was state prison, Get the facts straight. I was right. No, I was wrong. 38,000 are homeless. Sorry. 38,000 are homeless at any given time in California. 38,000 severely mentally ill people are homeless in California at any one time. 10,000 are incarcerated in county jails, thought to be 10% of the population. And at any one time, and this is probably the most disturbing of all, and I see these patients all the time, if they're on parole or if they've been in prison in the past, 20% of all state prisoners in the state of California are considered to have a serious mental illness. That's approximately 30,000 people. And I think that that's true. I'm not talking about things like ADHD and social phobia, which can be very disabling, but it's different from schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder or severe bipolar disorder. So the numbers of people incarcerated who probably in the past were living in a state hospital is actually pretty pretty daunting. So that brings us to today, and the way the LPS laws are written sort of makes the job very difficult for those of us who work on a day-to-day basis in psych emergency. The suicide card is there to be played, and you know, you adapt, you roll with it, you sort of sort out, you know, okay, this guy needs help, he just played the suicide card a little too hard, so I'm not going to hold it against him, I'm going to actually try to help him. Or this guy, he's not suicidal, he's just trying to get out of jail. Or this guy, holy Toledo, I think his suicide risk is exactly as high as he's, you know, he didn't play a suicide card, he's that suicidal. Of course, I'm going to admit him and or her and get them going with proper treatment. So you got to sort the suicide card out. But this other group of patients, I think, is much harder for us to deal with. And, you know, I have this conversation every day I work. Well, you know, this guy, you know, they're going to decertify him day two. But, you know, look at him. I mean, have you talked to him? I mean, I kind of want to tell the administrators, you go sit down with this guy for 5 minutes and tell me he's okay to go back out there. You know, so we're forced to make these decisions. I mean, it's easy enough for me to just admit the guy and saying, well, it's the right thing to do. Knowing that he might be discharged 4 days later and it's really not okay. So we're sort of stuck with this dilemma. I think that there's a lot of historical precedent that comes before us. And I think the problems today are still the same as they were, you know, when LPS was drafted. It's a combination, stinginess. It's expensive. To do psychiatric care properly, it's labor intensive, it's time consuming, it's expensive. The outcomes are a little bit gray. It can be a hard sell to someone who's making a budget. So granted, given that fact, I think we still need to be putting resources in that direction. I mean, if you want to do cost analysis, which I'm now hearing from sort of professional advocates and activists that the politicians aren't really swayed by anymore. I mean, is kind of what I'm hearing, that they don't really care about cost savings in the long run. Well, actually, it's not a surprise. I mean, look at how budgets are done, right? I mean, anybody sitting out there, you see how they do budgets. It's all short run. We're going to cut. We got to cut. And no one. And why they? Is it too much work? Is it too complicated to look at what are the long run costs of actually making this cut? Nobody's doing it, you know. So that's just a general voice of frustration, not just in mental health, but in other areas as well. But you know, my point is there are other costs when you make these short term cuts, and so they're but they're also really human costs. And I think at the end of the day, as someone who's a physician who takes care of the chronically mentally ill, I have to focus on human costs because I feel like that's, you know, that's my what I need to do. And that's really kind of why I wanted to talk about policy tonight and sort of let you know what it's like right on the front line. I am going to read one brief passage that illustrates this kind of patient, the latter part, if you want to go, you have to stay. Well, of course, this guy actually didn't admit because he wasn't really that he wasn't that sick. And let me tell you a little bit about this guy. So on the face of it, he seems like just a terminal alcoholic. And we see a lot of, you know, that's a subset of patients that we see of the people who absolutely cannot get sober, who are constantly brought to jail, to the medical ER, to the psych ER, and sort of desperately trying to get these guys off the streets, if for nothing else, that they're costing a huge amount of money. So on the face of it, this guy kind of looks like one of those guys, and he kind of acts like one of those guys, and the reading will sort of emphasize that. But the flip side is the guy that I'm going to describe in a moment also has chronic schizophrenia, and one of his hallmark symptoms is that of absolutely no, basically what I call heedless self-neglect. He's a guy who... It's amazing. People who are not troubled by wearing 8 layers of stinky, wet clothes, who haven't bathed in 3 months, no big deal. Hey, if I can find my next beer, I don't know. But I mean, it's, you know, that to me is, I hate to use the word crazy in and of itself. I mean, if you're really not troubled by living that way, there's something wrong. And there is something wrong. It's probably a neurological basis of heedless self-neglect that's been identified in the sickest of the sick. So that's a difference with this guy. Now, this guy, I don't really need to admit because he isn't dangerous. And frankly, at the end of the day, that is one of the criteria. Is he dangerous or not? He's not dangerous. He sure as hell doesn't want to be there. And he's not particularly symptomatic. In other words, he's not having active hallucinations. He's not having delusions. He's not otherwise seeming psychiatrically that acutely ill. You know, so I decide to let this guy go. But his name's Ray Shellam. And then we'll do Q&A after that, so I need to drink up first. All right. My apologies to those of you who have already heard this, which I think is not most of you, so. And now my reading glasses. I couldn't handle the progressives. I just couldn't go there. Who's got progressives out there? Raise a hand. Yeah, could you, I mean, didn't the first day or two just, didn't you feel, huh? Really? Oh, you guys, maybe your brains are wired differently than mine, I don't know. But I'm going to go to the, I'm going, when I go back to the reading glasses, I'm going to the old-fashioned bifocals, so. But I'm never going to get older. Okay. All right. So basically this is a very standard kind of interaction I might have with a patient on a daily basis. That's all right. When did you last have a regular place to stay? I asked Mr. Shellam.
About 10 years ago, the Civic Center Hotel. Then I lost my SSI, got kicked out. Couldn't afford it no more. I've been out on the streets ever since.
What's it like out there for you?
Well, it's gotten a little worse the last couple years, but I still prefer it to the shelters.
Why?
Mostly, Doc, I don't like being around all those people. All that coughing and crack smoking, it's kind of dangerous. You might get TB, you might get beat up. I'd rather take my chances in the alley. At least I got a cop walking by me a few times a night.
Anything else about the shelters?
Yeah, Doc, they kick you out at 6 a.m. You can't come back till 4 in the afternoon. I just got to drag my stuff around for 10 hours and then bring it back to the shelter. Might get ripped off there anyway.
You know, Ray, what you say about the shelters makes a lot of sense to me, but the thing I don't get about you is, why do you let your hygiene get so bad? Why don't you take a shower more often? He pauses. He looks up at me.
I don't know. I guess it just don't bother me.
Is it because there's nowhere to wash your clothes, take a shower?
Nah, I can usually find a shower in a shelter. Well, worst comes to worst, take one over at Martin's.
He says, referring to San Francisco charity mainstay Martin de Porres, which is on the south of Market end of Potrero Avenue, not far from the hospital. What about your clothes, Ray?
Well, Doc, that's easy. I usually panhandle enough to get drunk. I suppose I could use my change to do my laundry, but once I get drunk, about 10 or 11, my only focus is to stay drunk till I pass out later in the day.
What about food?
Sometimes I eat lunch at St. Anthony's, you know, one meal a day, but...
But what?
Well, I'm usually drunk by then, so I skip it. Sometimes I'll dig some food out of a garbage can. You'd be surprised how much those yuppies leave in the can.
And what do you drink?
Steel Reserve.
Ah, Rotgut Steely's, huh? That's what I say. The mention of his beverage of choice brings a smile to his lips.
Yeah, Doc, Steely's. Just a buck out the door.
So we're talking Steel Reserve high-gravity lager in a can. It's 24 ounces of malt liquor, has the viscosity of 5W30 motor oil, and a faintly sweet scent like that of watered-down maple syrup. At many neighborhood markets, a can costs 91 cents before taxes, just a buck out the door. And at 8.1% alcohol, packs nearly the wallop of four regular 12-ounce beers. Seeing as how one can rustle up $4 spare changing in an hour or two, is it any wonder that these dyed-in-the-wool alcoholics, who often fall down, seize, soil themselves, get hypothermia, get assaulted, get rolled, get belligerent with tourists, and occasionally walk naked into traffic, is it any wonder that they never get sober? Ray, how many cans do you drink in an average day?
Many as I can afford till I pass out.
How many does it take?
I don't know, 6, 7.
So to get an idea of this, consider that this amount of alcohol is equivalent to about a case of regular beer a day. So Ray Shellum, in front of me, has a bead of sweat forming on his forehead. His blood pressure is 170 over 105. He's shaking. He clearly is going into alcohol withdrawal. So I asked him when he had his last drink, and it was 4 the previous afternoon. So the treatment for alcohol withdrawal, which we see routinely in psychiatric emergency, we see a lot of medical things as well, is water, food, vitamins, and specific medications to hold off seizures. So physicians generally prescribe benzodiazepines, which are sedatives or minor tranquilizers such as Valium, Librium, Ativan, and Clonopin. So Ray, we're going to monitor and treat you for alcohol withdrawal, give you some vitamins, give you some Ativan. Have you ever been in residential alcohol treatment? He looks down and he mutters,
no.
Though I was highly skeptical and I almost certain of what his answer would be, I ask him, do you have any interest in going to residential alcohol treatment? Even if it was available, which it probably wouldn't be, but I can at least ask him.
Well, Doc, let me think about that.
So in the parlance of the sweet street-dwelling alcoholics of the world, that is a screaming no. He doesn't seem to mind getting cleaned up, getting some real food, getting detoxed and spending the night, but I sense he'll want out-of-psych emergency in the morning. But don't you want help? Don't you want to get off the streets, have a place to get clean, wash your clothes, to eat?
Nah, I like my freedom. I don't like being cooped up. Hotel was okay, but I like the street better. There's always something going on.
So that's Mr. Ray Shellum. Thanks for your attention. We're going to open things up to Q&A for, I suppose, about 15 minutes. And
okay, I'll pass the microphone around, and anybody has a question.
Do you ever have the opportunity to sort of circumvent the situation by admitting any of these people on a physical medical basis rather than a psych basis? And second, if I may ask too, is the fact that it's so hard to commit people unless they're willing, and like you say, you want to stay, you got to go, and vice versa, how much of an issue is that?
So the first question is very rarely. When they're in psych emergency, it's already determined that they're not physically ill enough to be admitted to the medical side of the hospital. And so we actually share a lot of patients back and forth. I will do consults in the regular ER. If I have someone who has a high fever or chest pain or some acute medical or emergent medical issue, I'll send them over. And so the people that I have in psych emergency already kind of by definition are not anywhere near medically ill enough to be admitted to the hospital, medical hospital. They're under really the same pressures as we are. I mean, there's not a disconnect. They're under tremendous pressure not to use their inpatient medical and surgical beds as well, because it's very expensive. So your second question is, well, it's a good question, and I think, you know, whether, you know, how to get people in the hospital who really need it, who don't want to go. I think what I always hope is, you know, rather than being adversarial, you know, and so that's the vast majority of patients I see, you know, rather than being, you know, adversarial, to try to have it be a partnership and say, hey, you know, here's what we might be able to help you with, you know, and form a partnership and an alliance and say, you know, we can maybe help you with housing after the hospital. But I want to talk to you about medication, and can we have a conversation? And so you might have somebody who's very skeptical, be able to have a conversation, and I would feel like I might have something reasonable to offer them in a moderate dose, not a huge dose that's going to make them feel like a zombie, that I'd rather work as a partnership. I think for, again, the sickest of the sick who often have trouble making decisions, I think the only, you know, you hope, the reality is some of those people, if you review their history, if they're on meds for a week, a lot of times they're a totally different person, you know, that they, well, I mean, a week, 2 weeks, I mean, that, and, you know, a lot of them feel clearer in their thinking and feel like, you know, they're more amenable to actually voluntarily getting treatment. So the catch 22 is people who don't want treatment, sometimes, you know, for me to give a shot to somebody against their will is a huge deal. And technically it's supposed to be imminent dangerousness for me to do that. Well, things have gotten a little more flexible over the years, partially because the medicines are much less toxic than they used to be. And so a lot of times someone will be just very, very ill and potentially dangerous. I mean, it's not in a vacuum. And I'll just say, listen, you know, you're going to get medicine, a pill or a shot, you know, your choice. So we've gotten a little bit more assertive about medicating people, and even one dose. So people on the verge of like slugging me or slugging somebody else, on the verge, they're lucky to be in the hospital, number one, because in a lot of places they'd be in jail. Number two, one shot of a low dose of something and they're a different person. Now, are they all better? No, they're not all better, but they're not coming to slug me, and I can actually sit down and talk to them. So, you know, seeing is believing in those kind of situations. So the goal is really to get a partnership and get people to trust you. So it's a long version.
I can't see that. Hi. First of all, I just wanted to say that tonight I'm freshly aware of how fortunate I've actually been to be 5150 more than once. I didn't realize I was so lucky. It was quite a long time ago. And I also want to ask you, I had the opportunity to go to Italy a few years ago, and I was able to connect with some people there who are very active in my, and my knowledge of this is very limited, but from what I know, Italy did some similar things to the United States simultaneously, but for very different reasons in terms of closing the asylums. Mm-hmm. There was almost entirely driven by compassion, and mm-hmm. because of that, there were people there who did things to make services available to the people that were the inmates of the asylums when they were open. They took a long time to do it, and then they didn't open the asylums immediately, and then by the time they did open the asylums, there were places for those people. Do you know about that stuff?
Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with that. In fact, an Italian psychiatrist came to the General and gave a grand rounds probably 4 or 5 years ago as a guest of Bob Oken, who's the former chief of psychiatry at the General. And I'm somewhat familiar with that. I'm not entirely familiar with that. I think, you know, in an ideal world, family members stay in the loop and stay supportive. And I think probably in many other parts of the world, family members are likely to stay in a supportive way. So I think there's probably some of that. I mean, I kind of think that in some ways also that the more homogenous your society is, the easier it is to do things like that. That I think that, you know, religiously, culturally, that it's a more, I mean, there are immigrants in Italy as well, but that it's a little bit more homogenous. But I think in an ideal world, we'd be able to offer people humane settings to live in, you know, and rather than just saying, you know, take your medicines or else, I mean, ideally we... Treatment involves much more than just taking your medicine. Absolutely, you know, therapy, vocational rehab, you know, other activities. And what I like to think of is helping people find a sense of meaning. You know, and that's kind of when I've done outpatient work with chronically mentally ill. If I have a 30-minute visit, I'll spend 5 minutes talking about the meds, 10 if it's complex. That gives me 20 to 25 minutes to talk about other things. How's your new girlfriend? How's that part-time job going? Hey, how do you like that class? Hey, I heard you went to a new church. And to me, actually, that helping people find a sense of meaning is probably the most useful thing you can do for someone. So I guess that's a side-winded way of saying I think there are ways we could do things differently. And what I know about the experience in Italy, that they have done a tremendous job in getting people out of institutions with community support, whereas here the support is catch as catch can. So,
walking around the streets of San Francisco, I get the sense that most of the street people are like the gentleman you just described. That being the case, is it likely we're always going to have a homeless problem in San Francisco because of the people who simply refuse care?
I think it's a good question. I mean, I do think there's probably always going to be a chronic, hardcore homeless population. I think a fair number of them probably more often than being psychiatrically ill have alcohol and drug issues. And I know with, you know, Care Not Cash, which I was pretty skeptical at first, but I think overall it didn't work too badly in that a lot of people got housed with Care Not Cash. I was really surprised when it rolled out 3 years ago. But there's still, and you read about this, there's definitely is a chronic core of homeless people who will refuse to go in. I think for people like Mr. Shellam, and he's a guy who's really not a dangerous guy. I mean, he's like kind of is more of a character, but, you know, obviously out there, that it would be nice to be able to get him some treatment, you know, and get him to stop drinking and then sort of try to get him into a situation of being indoors and, you know, feeling like he wants to, you know, take care of his basic needs more. But, I mean, I guess to answer your question, I have some pessimism about whether we're going to be able to really make the changes necessary. And I think a lot of it's based upon finances, you know, budget issues. So,
excuse me. When we talk about LPS and 5150, we're talking about California issues. I wonder if you could go federal, talk about how much this has happened all over the country. Is it like that, or is it a patchwork? What's going on?
I think it's pretty similar all over the country, and I think California did, you know, we pat ourselves on the back for being bellwethers, but with respect to LPS law, I think that we were a bellwether, that a lot of other states modeled their laws after LPS. And I think you've got similar issues across the country. I think actually California might be falling behind, though, in that I think in some states they have more of an implementation of what we call assisted outpatient treatment, or basically involuntary outpatient treatment. And you may have heard about something called Laura's Law. Basically, that's California's law for assisted outpatient treatment, passed in 2001 after a young woman was murdered by a psychiatric patient in a community clinic in Nevada County. So basically, the law says that counties can do involuntary outpatient treatment. The problem is they wrote the code in such a way that it's very complex, and they didn't give any money to go behind it as well. So they didn't fund it. They just said, you can do it, ha, 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 but we're not going to give you any money. So I think to answer your question, it's pretty universal. And I think, you know, California is maybe a little bit behind right now in trying to get ahead in treating patients. So
two questions. One of them is, this sounds like Ray lost his SSI. And do y'all not, is the hospital not able to present some kind of program to help them get into probably legal care so they can get their SSI? And then I'll go to the second question after you.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, absolutely. Those are, you know, helping people with their benefits is something that we do. So if someone loses their SSI, the hospital social worker will help them. I mean, more often than not, an outpatient case manager, a social worker will help them reapply. And I'm, you know, in this case, I might have added that for local color, but you know, the fact that, because that happens a lot. What happened in 1997 when they revamped SSI law? A lot of people who had significant alcohol and drug problems, they took their SSI away, and so a lot of, I mean, this guy obviously had more than that because he has a long psychiatric history. But yeah, I mean, we do try to help people get both apply for benefits and also, you know, get them reinstated if possible. I mean, I've done a lot of SSI forms, eligibility forms myself. So
the second question is about the fact is that there's been accumulating evidence that lead damage in childhood results in criminalization and violent behavior as a teenager and as an adult, and that adding in an evaluation for their lead load might label you to call them in lead encephalopathy, which might be a predictor for whether they're going to be violent. And whether the marijuana law, because since I think police are noting that if you're high in marijuana, you're simply not violent. whether that option gives you any options.
Well, the marijuana thing is too big a topic. I have my own opinions about it. But in terms of the lead and being associated with encephalopathy or other psychiatric symptoms, I mean, I think that there is a literature about lead and other heavy metals as well as possible toxins in the environment causing all sorts of neurological and psychiatric complications. And I do think that there would be room for actually us being more proactive in investigating for getting, you know, heavy metal screens more often. It is something we do talk about in residency and working someone up for dementia or for new onset psychosis. But I mean, I do think it's an area of investigation that is reasonable to look more closely at. So thanks for bringing that up.
Thank you very much for all of the information. I deal with this every day also. I've been a psychiatric nurse for over 30 years, so I've seen quite a few changes in California. And one of the things that I would like to express for most of the people here, I am one of the reviewers now that you talk about. And so, yes, the pressure is on to get out. And so, but also I want to remind everybody, it's just not the state or the local authorities, it's also insurance companies that will not give you the days that you really need for adjustment of medications to meet with families. They want them out. And if you don't get them out, they won't pay. So I just want to remind everybody, mm-hmm. It is also the insurances.
Excellent point. So you review for private insurers and the state both?
Yes.
Or, yeah.
And county. No. And for the county that I actually live in, they're the worst in California, I want you to know.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, no, the private insurance industry, and talking to my colleagues in private hospitals, they are ruthless about, you know, we're going to cut you off financially if you don't get this person out of here. So anyway.
All right. Our thanks this evening for Dr. Paul Lindy for his comments.
Thank you.
And now this program of the Commonwealth Club celebrating its 107th year of operation is closed.
Oh, I get to do it?
Yes.
Sweet!